This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The rallying cry of fake news has seeped into the world of science. Some pundits and politicians, including Donald Trump, call climate change a hoax. Some parents doubt the benefits of vaccines despite overwhelming scientific evidence. Dietram Scheufele researches public attitudes about science and about how scientists share their findings. He's a professor in science communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dietram is coming to North Carolina later this week for an event at Duke called Studying the Science of Science Communication in the Era of Social Media, Fake News, and Short Attention Spans. And he joins us now. Dietram, welcome to State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
Talk a little bit about this, because we are sort of debating, you know, people will say, well, how can we possibly argue over the facts? I think it was Daniel Moynihan who famously said, you have a right to your opinion, but not your own facts. Yet we sort of think we do these days, right?
No, absolutely. And I was just about to say, your previous segment kind of nicely highlighted that difference. We can disagree on abortion and have different opinions, but for science, it's really difficult, or it should be really difficult, to disagree on the facts. But it's actually really possible and happens all the time. And a lot of the political gridlock that we have over science comes directly from that disagreement over facts.
Now, the thing is, though, I mean, what science did was overturn, you know, was part of this revolution that overturned the divine right of kings, a kind of a clerical power over human thought, meaning science works at it and overturns its own theories, which is to say it is not the word of God. It is something that is mutable because the science changes. Isn't that part of our problem? We know that things can change, even though what's a fact today could be overturned by those very same scientists tomorrow.
Absolutely. It's one of two problems, I would say. I mean, one is, as you say, science is constantly self-correcting. It's constantly trying to prove itself wrong and push the boundaries of what is knowable. So it changes over time, and that's sometimes difficult, especially if it starts contradicting things that we tended or used to believe. But I think the other thing that what science does is it has implications for how we should live our lives, right? If climate change is real, that has real implications for what we should be doing to a fossil fuel industry. If vaccines are safe, then parents who may be asking for belief-based or other exemptions to not vaccinate their children may be in a bad spot because they're contributing or taking away from from herd immunity. So the second problem with science is that it very often suggests a path of action that contradicts our values and belief systems.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that, because I think values and beliefs are very much at the heart of this. And, you know, what do you do when a so-called fact just absolutely violates everything you believe about the moral universe?
Yeah, and I think what's really important about that is that phenomenon is actually true for all of us. Every so often, science contradicts values and beliefs for every single one of us. And in psychology, we often refer to this as motivated reasoning. So this idea that the exact same facts, even if we agree that they're true, will lead to very different conclusions and attitudes in all of us because we filter those facts through our belief systems. We call that confirmation bias. So if a fact fits what we already believe, we're more likely to integrate it into our attitudes and beliefs. And if it doesn't fit, we still acknowledge it's true. We just don't integrate it into our value system as much. And I think that's where really the problem comes in. And all of us do this to some degree. Where science has really run into problems is areas where scientists themselves have often violated people's values. So sometimes you have climate scientists like Michael Mann at Penn State tweeting that everybody with an R next to their name, meaning every Republican in Congress, is just not safe to have there because of their views on climate change. And that's usually not a good way of opening hearts and minds, by alienating everybody you want to talk to, meaning Republicans and climate change, with 280 characters, and then saying, but now you should really listen to me and listen to my facts. I think that's where we get into trouble if we politicize our own science.
But then how do we have this discussion? Because we're talking about, again, a belief system at the foundation of all of this, these unshakable and often, in many people, immutable beliefs. Is there room for discussion? I mean, you can't talk about a moral concept. If I think this is the bedrock, you may not do this because it violates everything I believe about morality and what is good. Where do we start that discussion? And that's liberals and that's conservatives. They all have that starting place. These are moral imperatives for liberals and for conservatives, not negotiable.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. This is not a partisan issue on one side or the other side of the aisle. This is this phenomenon holds for all of us, and strong values are being held on both sides. And I think your question gets to the heart of the matter. Where do we start communicating? And what we've done very often, we've communicated about the divisive issues, or even using terms that we know from the science of science communication, which is what we're going to be talking about at the end of the week at Duke. We've started from terms that we know divide. Climate change actually happens to be one of those terms. The moment I mention the word climate change, Republicans are less likely to listen to my message. We even know from research that if purchasing, for example, energy efficient light bulbs is actually not a partisan issue until we start putting an environmental label on the packaging, and then Democrats are much more likely to buy it, and Republicans are much less likely to purchase the exact same bulb, just because an environmental label is on it that basically provides a political cue. So the strategy is really to communicate toward values that bring us together. What are the commonalities we have around climate change, for instance? And the answer is at least two of them. One is the idea of global competitiveness for our economy. If we want to compete on the global energy market, we need to invest in green energy. Is that a matter of climate change? Maybe, but that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is global competitiveness, because that's something that both Democrats and Republicans can believe in. Or energy independence, not wanting to fight wars in countries that most of us can't accurately place on the map. If you don't want to do this, you have to invest in green energy. So in other words, communicating toward the commonalities, the things that bring us together rather than the ones that divide us. And very often, you know, wagging our fingers as scientists and saying, well, these are the things you need to believe in, otherwise you're ignorant, is not the best way of getting toward those shared values.
So I take the point. If you become aggressive in the way you use your language, if you begin accusing one party or the other of not listening, of being, you know, less intelligent because they won't take your facts on board, that's obviously a non-starter. But again, with this common ground, the fact is you will likely find a point, and now I have to get cynical for a moment, there are whole industries that are invested in not getting, you know, when climate change, for instance, fossil fuel industry not interested in common ground here. They really don't want to see you moving toward green energy. And they begin telling people, that argument about going energy independence is actually better suited to us and fossil fuels than them. Here are our facts, and here's why it's true that renewables are not the way to the future and not the way to it. And then you've got a whole battery of facts on that side and a battery of facts on the other side. So don't you end up in the same place just with a different vocabulary?
No, you're absolutely right if you simply focus on the vocabulary. But I think there are a number of things about science that are unique and that I think we can really rely on. One is scientists, and especially universities, are among the most trusted sources of information in the U.S. That continues to be the case as everything else, including the press, and my apologies, but the press and Congress and everybody else has declined in how much people trust them as information sources. Science has actually remained fairly stable or even slightly increased, with only the military as an institution enjoying higher levels of trust in the U.S. So I think that's a really good starting point for us. I think number two is that science makes a unique claim to producing knowledge. We're saying the information that we produce is neutral, it's objective, it's not driven by special interests. It is the best information and ways of knowing that we as a society have, given our procedures in science. And capitalizing on those two things and then saying, so now can I connect this to values that matter to you? This is why we want to invest in this kind of science. I think we have absolutely a winning message there if we don't get tempted and baited into basically partisan battles. The battles where scientists are either mocking the Trump administration for being anti-climate or mocking people who, and you know, again to your previous segment, who may have concerns about basic research using embryos or embryonic stem cells, or mocking people who oppose vaccinations. And I think that's, we've very often been tempted to basically mock people for not knowing as much as scientists do. And as I said, none of us would respond well to that. So it's both intuitively and based on the best available social science not true.
Then who's responsible for getting the message out? Because right now it's all mediated. It has to come either through, you know, sort of a mainstream press, and we can get to that in a moment, which often doesn't give the research a fair enough treatment. It tends to water things down and therefore distort the message.
Yeah,
or social media, you know. So what's the response? Should scientists be talking directly to the people?
I think to some degree, yes. I do think, though, and that science journalism and public television, public radio, and newspapers continue to play an important role. So these legacy media in translating highly complex science into 300 words or even a 30-second segment that tells us as citizens why this matters to us and why we should pay attention. But I do think that scientists themselves have a huge role to play. And it's partly why we're meeting at Duke as part of the Science and Society Initiative there to really think about some of the interfaces between science and society. Here at Wisconsin, we even have a PhD minor that trains geneticists in being better communicators and helping them to really seek a broader dialogue with the public. So I think that's at least part of the solution.
And again, you do that through legacy media, you do that through journalism, or are there more direct avenues that you would recommend?
There are absolutely direct avenues. Like Twitter, like social media, we can't complain that there are other voices out there that spread misinformation if we're not in those same channels that are being used widely, providing the best available information to inform some of those discussions. Not all of these discussions are going to be just about the science. They're going to be about the regulatory and the policy implications, but that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be informed by the best available science. So absolutely, I would urge scientists to use all available channels and go to where their audiences are, rather than hoping that those audiences will come to them.
It seems to me when people have questions about science, there's, one issue might be credibility, but another one really is the direction of science. Where's this taking us? Is it safe? That sort of thing. And we talk about emerging technologies, artificial intelligence, genetic engineering, all those things. And, to take it back several decades to nuclear technology, it scares the life out of people and they wonder what to make of it all, even if you're telling the truth. In fact, especially if you're telling the truth about all this.
Yeah, and I think Bill Gates wrote on his blog a little while ago that these new gene editing technologies using CRISPR, so these new tools that allow us to edit, the most important conversation that we're not having right now. And so I think that just highlights the need for a broad societal conversation, with scientists being at the table, with scientists providing input on those debates. And AI being not any different. These things are going to fundamentally change how we interact with one another, what it means to have a job, to work in gainful employment, what it means to be human, and so on. And I think these broader debates really are they're coming, and science, the scientific community better be prepared for them.
Well, are they coming or aren't they? I mean, when you talk about a broad debate, CRISPR for one, genetic engineering, the idea, I mean, we've already seen the fact that we can engineer an embryo, a human child has been engineered before it was born. It's already here, and AI is here. There's a lot of money involved in this, and there's a lot of ways in which partisan identities will be attached to outcomes, and we have as our primary means of communication these days, social media, which has siloed us even further. Do you really think there's going to be a conversation about this?
So there's at least a lot of efforts to try and put together this conversation. And I think what's encouraging is that we're seeing AI as a good example where places like DeepMind, so this is Google's AI arm, is routinely doing town halls and public meetings with members of the public to really have a conversation and help inform how they think this should be rolled out, and members of the public. I think we're seeing this at the federal level, where the National Academies has invested a lot of effort. The National Academies of Science and Engineering and Medicine have invested a lot of efforts into building these what they call public engagements. So this is again actively seeking these conversations. And even at universities, we at Wisconsin have an NSF grant, for instance, that tries to figure out ways of enabling these conversations with scientists and citizens without polarizing and depolarizing those conversations in the first place. So I think both scientists and federal agencies and foundations, but also industry, are really interested. And it's maybe a little bit cynical from the industry side because they've seen some of the backlash against previous technologies and they want to avoid that. But where the motivation is for me is not as important as where they put their money, and right now they are seeking, at least some of them are seeking that discourse. So I agree with you, it's not a given, but people are working toward it.
It seems to me that you don't really have to have a public forum. You just put enough Alexas and Echoes in people's houses and just hear what they're talking about. You can aggregate that information.
And of course, that's highlighting the point that you made about some of this stuff being really creepy. You may have seen the news story in Europe where under new privacy laws, a German person asked Amazon for all of the recordings, his Alexa recordings, and he got 6,000 of them that Alexa had on file. To make it even more creepy, they sent him 6,000 from somebody else by accident. So he had 6,000 recordings from a person he didn't even know that he could now listen to. So that's how creepy some of that stuff is already.
You talked about the fact that there are these conversations going on. People are taking it seriously. What form do they take? How do you depoliticize, given the fact that our identities now are attached to so many of these issues? What do you see? How does it take place? Describe it for me.
Yeah, and I'm going to start with just also highlighting what's going wrong typically, because you mentioned social media and we haven't talked about it all that much. And the economic incentives, of course, for social media is to give us a news diet that fits as closely as possible our own prior views and values, right? The more time I spend on a platform like Facebook or Google, the more money they make off of the data that I provide while I'm spending time there. So in other words, there's no incentive for them to give me anything that I disagree with, any viewpoint that it may drive me to another platform. So there is a huge economic incentive to give me exactly, to basically feed my already existing beliefs. And that's not a good thing. Democratically, we want the exact opposite. We want to have an exchange of opinions. So what a lot of the efforts have focused on public engagement is to bring groups together and to use trusted conveners like museums, for instance, where we're don't seeing this wide partisan gaps where Democrats like them and Republicans don't, or universities. We do the same thing here at Wisconsin, and a lot of other universities do the same thing, trying to bring different groups together, religious groups, for instance, on human genome editing, scientific groups, citizen and patient groups, parents, and talk about what their perspectives are on the exact same issue. And as I said earlier, I think those are beginning to be much more widespread and even have industry participation in many cases.
Do you think also that science needs to be a little more humble about what I would call unintended consequences? Because you can stick to the fact narrowly described, and it sounds pretty good. Antibiotics kill bacteria that have saved many, many lives. They've also now begun to create superbugs and are implicated in autoimmune disorders and the proliferation of that. So the unintended and same with vaccines. We know that they are good against the measles. We don't know what other effects these are having in the aggregate because we're not really measuring that. We're not even asking that question. So are they, not for your individual and not for your individual community of measles, are they having other effects? Are we measuring that? And can we trust science to fess up when it said, oh, we didn't think of that?
Yeah. And science, I think, is very good at dealing with many of the technical aspects of things, and even some of the impacts of measles that you're talking about, long term or of genetically modified crops, the ecological impacts. Science is actually pretty good at tracking that over time. It will just take a while. I would push your argument even further. I totally agree with you, and I would push it even further and say, well, the unintended consequences very often are social in nature. Right, so we're concerned about AI, we're concerned about our recordings getting out, we're concerned about privacy, but what will happen to our economy when large numbers of areas of employment are just going to go away because they're going to be automated? What happens to our understanding of race once we're able to edit skin color? What happens to our national security once we're able to create super soldiers that are stronger, taller, and more intelligent and don't have to sleep? So a lot of the things that the long-term consequences are actually consequences that really science themselves cannot answer. They're societal questions. And I usually give my students one example, and that is if 20 years ago I had told people that they would at some point carry around, or they would have to carry around, a little device that where the government and corporations can listen to any conversation, they will read all their emails, they will always know exactly where they are, and every piece of data that they send through that device will be recorded and stored, there would have been a civil war.
Yeah.
And now we have cell phones. And so that's kind of where the perfect example, I think.
Dietram Schoeffel is a professor of science communication at the University of Madison, Wisconsin-Madison. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank.
It's going to be at Duke University on the campus Thursday afternoon for a free event called Studying the Science of Science Communication in the Era of Social Media, Fake News, and Short Attention Spans. You can register for the event. You can find out more about it at our website, stateofthings.org. Absolutely true. It's a fact. Stateofthings.org. It exists. It's real. Go there. I guarantee it. Just ahead, we're going to talk to Belle Boggs about her debut novel, The Gulf. Stay tuned.